not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Broadcasting from the Gulag city of planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. This is Richard Lake of MapInc.org speaking of Tom Crosland and Raleigh Rome of Rainbow Farm.
Basically, Rainbow Farm is a campground that was in Vidalia, Michigan for a number of years in the late 1990s. It became a place where countercultural folks would come to stay at the campground, and casual use of marijuana was common on the property. Eventually, it got to the point where they decided to do concerts, a Hemp 8 concert in a Memorial Day weekend, and something called Roach Roast on Labor Day weekend. That aggravated the local district attorney, who slowly but surely went on a vendetta to try and close the farm down. What happened is taking the farm as asset forfeiture, also threatening to take away Raleigh's son Robert, and it's been called perhaps another Ruby Ridge. It's a tragic event, an unnecessary killing of basically a couple of peaceful hippies who are trying to make a little utopia. I guess one of the real things to remember is that the state and people in power can, in fact, screw with you, and screw with you and drive you to the wall. They made their choice that, you know, that they were willing to pay that price, and to me, they are real martyrs, heroes. They fought for what they believed in. The state didn't get any of it. All they got was scorched earth. That's the statement that they wanted to make, and that's the statement that they'll be remembered for. We will keep the remembering Tom and Raleigh. We will never forget. The memorial website is rainbowfarmcamp.com.
The current issue of Playboy features a story about Rainbow Farm and the FBI's killing of Tom and Raleigh.
Satan is real.
Police officer, open the door.
Marijuana smoking, experts point out, can make a helpless addict of its victim within weeks, causing physical and moral ruin and death.
Tonight we travel to another dimension, where pot is legal, yet arrests still go on. We are traveling to Canada. Our guests for this evening have seen the benefits and the horrors of the war on drugs, serving in the front lines of the informational wars as the gurus of DrugSense.org and the media awareness project, MapInc.org. We're going to first bring in Matt Elrod, the man who supports my website and dozens, if not hundreds of others, from his home in British Columbia. And in just a few moments, we'll bring in his cohort, Philip Lucas, who not only works on the war on information, but also helps to run the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, a pot pharmacy. Hello, Matt. Would you tell my listeners a bit about yourself?
I'm, as you know, the webmaster of the Media Awareness Project, but I'm also involved with a lot of organizations in North America, United States, and Canada. And that alone is a whole show worth of information to talk about. We can talk about the differences between Canadian policy, and we'll be talking about how you can help, and especially how you can help on the Internet, because that's my specialty. I help out sites getting online, provide them with tactical support and email lists, and get them active on the Internet. And So we'll be talking about what needs to be changed and how we can change it, and all sorts of fun stuff.
Okay, a comment I'd like for you to make. Would you do a comparison between the number of hits that hit the Office of National Drug Control Policy site versus what you guys garner on Map, Inc. and Drug Sense?
Right, right. Well, we've done analysis of our own, but also there's independent organizations like Web Trends and, I've forgotten the name of them, Alexis, I think, that analyze the popularity of websites. And according to them, our website, just the Media Awareness Project News Clipping Service, gets more traffic than the ONDCP site, the PDFA site, the NIDA site, et cetera, all combined. We haven't done that analysis for a while, but that was a few years ago, and we've only become much more popular since. For example, our news services, you may have noticed, fed to a number of drug policy reform sites, NORMAL, MPP, you know, et cetera, DPA. And so as a consequence of that, we propagate the news on a level of magnitude higher than anything that that they're doing on the other side. So, yeah, as a consequence, our websites are far more popular than the websites that are, than websites that promote prohibition.
Speaking of which, here's a little bit of a soundbite from the other side. This from our illustrious drug czar, John Walters.
The line that's been presented to Americans as well as Canadians is marijuana is not a serious drug of abuse. That's not true. You can't be addicted to marijuana. That's not true. That's archaic views of what marijuana was left over from the Cheech and Chong years of the 70s. Today, we have to not be subject to reefer madness, and forget the fact that high-potency marijuana in particular is being used by teenagers at younger and younger ages. The brain science we have shows it's a dependency-producing substance. We do not need, on either side of the border, more of our citizens harmed. More Canadians are likely to be harmed if consumption continues to go up. The view that if we relax our effort, we suggest send the message that marijuana is not a serious threat. If we say that use and possession is something that we're going to diminish, as the United States has done in the past, there is no question that common sense and history show the same thing. You get more marijuana use. You get more marijuana-impaired drivers on the highway doing harm. You get more young people whose lives are taken off track as a result of marijuana use and frequently other drug use. You get more communities. We in the United States have had 25 years of painful experience. No family, no community, no nation is better off with more drug use. People who try to tell Americans marijuana is not something you got to pay attention to, it's a lie.
Okay, now, let's go ahead and bring in Philippe Lucas of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society.
Okay, Philippe, I want to ask you something. Are the authorities leaving you and your Compassion Club alone?
Well, I'm happy to say, Dean, that in Victoria, our club hasn't had too much trouble. We've been around for 4 years now, and about 14 months after we opened up, I was arrested and charged with 3 counts of trafficking, but that led to a very positive legal decision in which a judge granted me an absolute discharge and actually ordered the police to return our money and our equipment. And since that time, we haven't had any trouble. However, there's another club a little bit more underground in town, and they've been busted 4 times in the last 2 years. And just in the last year, we had one of Canada's biggest clubs in Toronto, the Toronto Compassion Center. It got busted. And so, unfortunately, medical marijuana is, although it may be legal here in Canada, the distribution of medical marijuana is still problematic.
I find it rather interesting that in the U.S., they spend billions of U.S. tax dollars to stop medical marijuana, yet in Canada, the government now provides it. Is that correct?
Yeah, but I think that leads to a misimpression. In California alone, you guys have over 50,000 registered medical marijuana users. We have a federal program here in Canada, and 4 years of operation and $10 million spent, they've only signed up 500 people in all of Canada. And so the idea that we're ahead, I think, is a little bit confusing to a lot of Americans. I think that in California, you guys are way ahead of Canada right now. It's just compared to some of the more conservative states that the Canadian policy looks like it makes any sense.
There's a gentleman up there, the Prince of Pot, Mark Emery, who's making a circuit of the major cities of Canada. How are his efforts going?
They're going really well. I actually really enjoyed the way that he's going about doing this. He's showing up at all the police stations in the major metropolitan areas in Canada, and at 4:20 he's lighting up a pipe or a bong and getting arrested in some, in fact in most. I think he's been arrested in 7 out of 10 stops he's made so far, to call attention to an important legal decision called the Rogan decision, which found that our cannabis laws are in no force in effect in Ontario, and Mark's trying to push the point and say that that should be applied to all the provinces. It's a neat protest because it's got a real grassroots kind of feel to it. He doesn't advertise his appearances, and yet in some cases hundreds of people show up, and I think he's setting up a good precedent there. I think he's going to show how ridiculous these laws are. He's getting really good bust, under a gram, and in some cases, like in I think it was outside of Winnipeg, he was actually shackled for his under a gram of cannabis. And so we can see that in Canada, we're not quite the nirvana that's often portrayed in the U.S.
So tonight, in counterbalance to some of the points being made, here's the voice of the Deputy Director of Homeland Security, Asa Hutchinson.
There are some in this conference, perhaps, and in our society, that want to legalize marijuana. They want to focus on that and not talk about perhaps heroin and marijuana cocaine, methamphetamine, but they want to focus on marijuana. They believe that it is less harmful than other drugs. And I think it's very important to be honest with our young people particularly and not paint a picture of marijuana or a specific drug that is not honest and factually based. We shouldn't over-dramatize a particular drug. But at the same time, we should not minimize the impact of a drug that is harmful, such as marijuana. In 1999, more than 200,000 Americans entered substance abuse treatment primarily for marijuana abuse and dependence. Adolescent admissions to substance abuse facilities for marijuana grew from 43% in 1994 to 60% in 1999. I could give you specific instances of it from Dawn, a 17-year-old New Yorker who started smoking marijuana with her friends when she was age 12. She said she did it to relax on weekends, but pretty soon it became an everyday habit. And then she said this, "I learned something one day, and the next day I have no idea what the teacher was talking about." That was the impact of marijuana on her ability to learn and to recall. And so while some people are able to quit marijuana and only use it socially or recreationally, others are not so fortunate and develop serious addiction problems. Marijuana use does have consequences. It may not cause the overdose deaths like heroin or cocaine, but its cumulative effects are just as dangerous.
Well, heavens forbid that a school child would forget what their teacher said the previous day. Matt, tell us a little bit about the public attitude towards marijuana and perhaps medical marijuana in Canada versus what we see in the U.S.
Well, you know, looking at the opinion polls, it looks like we've got about 70% for decrim. It gets up to high 80s or 90s, depending on who you ask when you go to medical marijuana support. That is to say, you know, marijuana should be legally available to those who need it for medical reasons. So our numbers, I guess, are, what, 10%, 20% higher than yours, something like that. And it varies, of course, from province to province, with BC and Quebec being the most in favor of reform and Alberta being our sort of Bible Belt, the most conservative. And I think they're marginally prohibitionist, that is to say less than 50% support decrim even. And our numbers on legalization and decriminalization are just higher than yours. And I guess there's a lot of reasons for that, but our Charter of Rights and Freedoms kind of changes the way laws are exercised in Canada, and it's been ruled unconstitutional to deprive a medical marijuana user of cannabis. That was all started by a number of patients, specifically a man named Terry Parker, who had epilepsy and who had tried every conventional medicine. And proved to not only the lower courts, but I think through two appeal courts, to their satisfaction in a court of law, that he needed this drug, or I should say this herb. And the courts agreed. And from that, the law just sort of came crumbling down because there was no provision with zero tolerance. It's brittle. It breaks if you try to bend it. And that's what happened. So now they're, trying to pick up the pieces, theoretically by coming up with medical marijuana provisions, but these have been found unconstitutional so far. And the new Decrim bill that, they've tabled in the House also lacks a medical provision, so I think it's unconstitutional out the gate.
It kind of makes you wonder just how successful has the U.S. drug war been? Well, here to comment on that subject is U.S. Congressman Dan Burton.
I want to tell you something. I have been in probably 100, 150 hearings like this at various times in my political career, and the story is always the same. This goes all the way back to the 60s, 35, 40 years ago. And every time I have a hearing, I hear that people who get hooked on heroin and cocaine become addicted, and they very rarely get off of it. And the scourge expands and expands and expands. And we have very fine law enforcement officers like you go out and fight the fight, and you see it grow and grow and grow, and you see these horrible tragedies occur. But there's no end to it. And I see young guys driving around in tough areas of Indianapolis in cars that I know they can't afford. And I know where they're getting their money. I mean, there's no question. A kid can't be driving a brand new Corvette when he lives in the inner city of Indianapolis in a ghetto. And you know that he's got to be making that money in some way that's probably not legal and probably involves drugs. Over 70% of all crime is drug-related, and you've alluded to that today. We saw on television recently Pablo Escobar gunned down, and everybody applauded that and said, that's the end of the Medellin cartel. But it wasn't the end. Yeah, there's still a cartel down there. They're still all over the place. When you kill one, there's 10 or 20 or 50 waiting to take his place. You know why? It's because of what you said just a minute ago, Mr. Carr and Mr. Marcucci. And that is, there's so much money to be made in it. There's always going to be another person in line to make that money. And we go into drug eradication, and we go into rehabilitation, and we go into education, and we do all these things. And the drug problem continues to increase, and it continues to cost us not billions, but trillions of dollars. Trillions! And we continue to build more and more prisons, and we put more and more people in jail, and we know that the crimes that they're committing are related most of the time to drugs. So I have one question I'd like to ask all of you, and I think this is a question that needs to be asked. I hate drugs. I hate people who succumb to the drug addiction, and I hate what it does to our society. It's hit every one of us in our families or friends of ours. But I have one question that nobody ever asks, and that's this question. What would happen if there was no profit in drugs? If there was no profit in drugs, what would happen? I'd like for any of you to answer that. If they couldn't make any money out of selling drugs, what would happen?
Okay, before we get back with Philippe Lucas and talk about the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, I thought you might like to hear this song from David Rovix.
I wish I was up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Saint Amelia at the beginning of the day. But here I am in New York City, hiding out in Central Park, getting kidnapped by the police. Today is sometime before dark, but I wish I was up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Saint Amelia at the beginning of the day. The judge looked down upon me frowning. He said, kid, get on your way. Just don't start out your mornings with espresso in the J. I said, I wish I was up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Saint Amelia at the beginning of the day. hitched a ride out to Portland. Caught one up to BC. Took a bus over to Hastings Street to have a bowl with my coffee. Now I'm up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Sensimilia at the beginning of the day. Now I'm up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Sensimilia at the beginning of the day.
Okay, Matt Elrod, before you leave us for the evening, I was wondering if you'd do me the favor of doing that on-air promo I was talking to you about.
Okay. Hi, this is Matt Elrod of the Media Awareness Project calling from Victoria, B.C. You're listening to Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth.
And I want to send out a great thank you to Matt for joining us. He is the computer guru at mapinc.org. That's MAPINC.org. Thanks, Matt. Okay, and now back to Philippe Lucas of drugsense.org.
Oh, yes. I can't remember the exact number. There was a police association release in the last week or so that indicated that they thought marijuana was an important issue and that the law should not be decriminalized. And I'm wondering... What gives these police justification to make medical decisions?
It's very frustrating to me because literally cannabis is the only crime in Canada and possibly North America where we see police actively lobbying for stronger laws. We don't see police actively lobbying for stronger penalties for violent assault or for rape or for incest. We see police lobbying for stronger penalties for growing plants in your basement. And to me that shows the inherent corruption of the drug war. If the police weren't involved, if they didn't depend so badly on cannabis especially, but the drug war in large part to fund their departments, I don't think that we'd see this kind of interest. We could move on to more serious issues that the police should be dealing with, such as predatory crime, such as violent assault. And so I think it's just reflective of what's going on with the drug war and the waste and the corruption that it brings with it.
Okay, let's say drug prohibition does support terrorism.
And murder.
And murder.
Torture.
And torture.
Corruption. Bribery.
And whatever.
What's your point?
Change the law.
I gotcha. Make it cheap. More available. Everywhere. Like soda or cheesy puffs.
Exactly.
Cocaine at the playground. Crack stands at the laundromat. Heroin at the mini mart. Like that?
Face it, old man. That's what we've got now.
To learn more, visit the Marijuana Policy Project, MPP.org. Philippe, I heard of a situation where some people, I think you call the backbenchers, were working to subvert the drug laws.
You were talking about some of the MPs that were met with U.S. authorities to try and... We had a couple of liberal backbenchers who met with representatives from the DEA to try and force the issue... to try and get the U.S. to force the issue regarding Canada's moves towards decriminalization, to try and tie things like shutting down the border with that decriminalization effort. And so it's really an amazing thing to me that you would have elected Canadian officials going to U.S. officials, unelected U.S. officials, to try and get them to change Canadian policy through pressure that could really result in things as serious as trade sanctions. It could really affect the business here in Canada. To me, that's in any circumstances that would be unacceptable. But the fact that these people actually come from the same party that put forward the cannabis reform bill makes this whole story really beyond belief here in Canada.
Have you ever wondered whether a drug-free America is a realistic goal? Many people are beginning to realize it is just not possible to have both a free America and a drug-free America. I choose freedom. America's claim as leader of the free world is in jeopardy due to the war on drugs. How can we lead in freedom when we imprison more of our own citizens than any other country in the world? Does that sound like America to you? Let's return freedom to America. End the war on drugs.
Ed Forshin, njweedman.com. Philippe, this whole situation is just way beyond belief, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely, Dean. It's and it continues, unfortunately. In so much as we see some progress, it's always hesitant. Our government isn't moving towards liberalization without kicking and screaming. They're not distributing medical marijuana without court orders, and so none of this is being done out of compassion. None of this is being done in good faith, unfortunately.
And one more thought occurs to me. In that you say you've had 4 years of fairly well uninterrupted experience with your Compassion Club, have you been able to find certain seed strains, certain types that work for, you know, a sundry of medical problems?
We do. We've found that there's certainly certain strains that are better for certain conditions than others. Typically, those are broken down into two subgroups, indicas and sativas. But we've moved beyond that at the Vancouver Island Compassion Society to find individual strains that appear to work. Now, we say appear because we're talking about observational experience here, but in the fall, we'll be starting here at the Vancouver Island Compassion Society the first high-THC clinical trial, double-blind clinical trial for pain and analgesic effects of cannabis. And we're really excited about it. This has never been done anywhere else in North America, maybe not in the world. We'll be using cannabis as high as 20% THC and trying to see how well it deals in mitigating pain and affecting appetite and sleep as well.
Well, Philippe, I want to thank you for joining us here on Cultural Baggage, and I want to remind the listeners that this is Pacifica Radio, the Drug Truth Network. Our guests for this evening have been Matt Elrod, the computer guru of MapInc.org, and Philippe Lucas, the head of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society. I want to alert the listeners that just this week we picked up three new stations that will be broadcasting our shows, WZRD in Chicago, The X in Columbus, British Columbia, and KZFR in Chico, California. Welcome to the Drug Truth Radio Network. I want to invite you all to please join us this next Tuesday. That'll be September 9th. We're going to have 2.5 hours of drug war programming from 10 a.m. to noon Central Time. We'll discuss the government's attempt to tie drug use in with the war on terror. Our guests will be Dr. Mitch Earlywine, Dr. David Duncan, author Mike Gray, and from the Institute of Policy Studies, San Ho Tree. And from Canada, we're going to bring in barrister Eugene Oscapella. And then at our regular time of 6:30 to 7 p.m. Central, we'll bring on Al Giordano of Narconews.com, and we'll continue this look at the silent war on drugs that is turning into the war of terror. Well, that's about it, I guess. And as always, in closing, I ask that you please remember, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. So please, be careful. For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.